And welcome to this edition of the Hagmann Report. Have we got a guest for you? Let me tell you something. This man is, I love this guy. I love him. Seriously, I like his research. I think he's an incredible researcher. His background is just absolutely incredible. And I don't want to take too much time bringing him on, you know, with platitudes and such. I want him to get really, I want to start really with the nitty gritty of information. Before I do, I just want to again thank you for all the people who have sent emails, including Connie and others, and Gary from England, and thank you for your kind words, and thanks for listening to the program. But James Perloff, who's written a number of books, he's a prolific author, he's a researcher. I can go on and on and on. And his books, his website is jamesperloff.com. It's in the program description. The link there is in the program description. Truth is a lonely warrior. Indeed it is. And we're finding that out day by day. Is he on? Eric, do we know? Oh, he's on? All right. James, if you want to click the video button on your Skype, we can bring you on. Or if you just want audio, it's up to you. But welcome to the Hagmann Report. All right, it looks like we're having a little bit of trouble connecting or getting that connection worked out. Again, James Perloff, and the website formerly refugebooks.com, but it's James Perloff, PERLOFF.com. And he was on once before, and we got just such a tremendous positive response. We had talked about the true story behind Pearl Harbor, and you talk about a great historian and setting the stage for what really happened during that period of time, as proved, not proven, but proved by the recent documents. There we go. I hear him in my, I hear it in my ear. James Perloff, welcome back, sir, to the Hagmann Report.
Thank you guys for having me back.
Hey, man, I'll tell you, I missed you, and I've often thought about our interview. And I watched it a couple of times, actually, since you were last on. When was that? Do you remember?
Well, I think we did on the anniversary of Pearl Harbor. I think we've done a couple of interviews, but
right.
We did a December 7th interview on Pearl Harbor Day.
That's right. That's right. Okay. You know, I bring it up. I don't pay attention to the dates, but I guess yeah. You'll have to excuse me. It's been a long day, radio and TV, so...
Sure.
But nonetheless, but that to me, was really an eye-opening segment that you did on Pearl Harbor. Not enough time to get into everything that you had there, and how everything was known, and the documentation that you brought forth proved the fact that the, you know, attack on Pearl Harbor was known in advance by the powers at the time, which was just, you know, you hear that and you think, how is that even possible? But we invited you back, and we could talk about the current events against the historical backdrop of things like Pearl Harbor. We could talk about 9/11, and of course, what I'd like to get your read on, especially, is the Trump White House, the condition thereof right now, and of course Mueller being completely compromised, and what the deal is, because it seems like between the radical groups and between the leaders and between the special prosecutor and the deep state, the shadow government, seems like they're trying to get Donald Trump out of the White House.
Mm-hmm.
What's yours? You know, and again, feel free to start wherever. This is your time. I really want a warm introduction to James Perloff, because I really value this man's research and opinion. I think he's an A1 researcher, class A researcher. So, having said that, I want to defer to you in a way as to what, you know, maybe triage what we're going through right now. And I love history. So at any time history would apply to our current situation, you feel free to go down any road that you want to go. But let's just have a chat for the next two long segments here. And let's talk about things that are important to James Perloff and your research and your findings.
Well, actually, the direction I'm headed in now is one that I don't normally do, which is 9/11. And the reason I say I don't normally go into 9/11 is that so much great research has been done, so much has been found over the years, although we still have tremendous debates, don't we, over the details.
And James, I got to tell you this. We have people on that say no planes, army planes, particle beam weapons, scalar technology. Israel did it. George Bush did it. He was down in the basement with a button. So 9/11. I'm interested in your take, and I think you've got, I'm sure, a very well researched and well reasoned take. I didn't mean to go into that, but.
No, that's what I was going into, was that there are so many takes on it. And the only reason that I've gone into 9/11 is that I've been in touch with people who had some information that was fresh. And I wrote an article called 9/11 Simplified, and I talked more specifically about the who, and I broke the how into three parts, how the Twin Towers collapsed and what hit the towers and what happened to the planes and passengers. And there were some fresh dimensions in all of that. But then I was contacted after writing that post by six pilots, none of whom accept the official 9/11 story. And two of them had been scheduled to fly Boeings on 9/11. And one of them was a pilot born in the United Kingdom who still is actively flying Airbuses today. And he had so many insights into aviation, because he used to train pilots for the airlines, that he and I exchanged a lot of emails. And this guy actually is a very good writer. He's entertaining and well-informed. And finally, I decided, you know, this guy's emails would make a great post. So I ordered the emails a little bit, but I almost didn't have to edit them because his writing was so good. And I turned it into my most recent blog post at jamespurloff.com. It's called Conversations with an Airline Pilot About 9/11. He was able to clear up a number of aspects about 9/11 from an expert aviation viewpoint. But he also was very much in favor of the theory that I had proposed in the article, 9/11 Simplified. And so I thought I'd talk about 9/11 just because I think there are some items that your readers your listeners and watchers will not have heard before. Although if people have heard me talk about 9/11 recently, they can say, oh no, this is redundant.
Mr. Perloff, and again, I don't mean to overtalk you or interrupt, but I got to say this. I read your article prior to the show, and I've got to say that it was very well done. And I think out of all of the even more recent articles, this struck me as being, I don't know, this to me, let's get into this article as you wish. And I think because everything we're seeing happen today, taking place today, in my view, is a consequence of, at least in part, of the what happened on 9/11. So you've got free rein, and I would urge everyone to go to jamesperloff.com and read this article, because you had me basically at about the third paragraph. It was the second paragraph, actually. So go ahead. Yeah, let's talk.
So the article you're referring to might be the main one, 9/11 Simplified, because
That was the one you did, I think, in July, and then the other one was Conversations with an Airline Pilot About 9/11. Mm-hmm. So, however, in whatever order you want to take them, but it's fantastic research, I think.
Okay. Maybe we can spend the first hour tonight, since you generously give me 2 hours, maybe we can spend the first hour on 9/11 and then go in other directions.
Okay.
The article begins with a who, and I think a very important matter to recognize in regards to 9/11 is that the who keeps pointing in the direction of Israel. And I should probably preface my remarks by saying that I'm half Jewish myself, so this isn't based on anti-Semitism, which is sort of a knee-jerk response people sometimes give to critics of Israel. But if you look at 9/11, first of all, it wasn't dancing CIA agents or dancing Arabs. It was dancing Israelis that were arrested by the New York police that had been photographing the event, and they were caught by neighbors. And CNN reported it that day, but when it turned out those Israelis, it disappeared from the headlines. And one reason it disappeared from the headlines was that the man put in charge by the Justice Department with the investigation of 9/11 was Michael Chertoff, whose mother was a Mossad agent. And at least two of these five dancing Israelis were Mossad agents. But then you start to look and you see, if you look at airport security, security at all the airports involved with 9/11 was handled by an Israeli-owned firm, and specifically owned by Ezra Harel and Menachem Matzam, two Israelis. And then World Trade Center security was in the hand of Kroll Associates, and it was Jules and Jeremy, and they're hardcore Zionists linked to Israel. And then, of course, the new owner of the World Trade Center, we all know, was Larry Silverstein. Now, lucky Larry became owner less than 2 months before 9/11. He invested $124 million. He got a $5 billion payout. You can't do that good in the futures market, even on a lucky month. He was such good friends with Benjamin Netanyahu that every Sunday, according to the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, Netanyahu would call Silverstein. Silverstein wasn't calling Netanyahu. Netanyahu would call Silverstein every Sunday in the weeks leading up to 9/11, our new owner, who luckily happened to be not at the World Trade Center on the day of 9/11 due to a fortuitous doctor's appointment. Okay, then we've got companies involved. We've got Odigo, the Israeli instant messaging company, whose employees received a message 2 hours before the attack warning them not to be in the World Trade Center. We have Zim Navigational, the one major Israeli firm in the World Trade Center, had been there, I believe, for about 30 years, and then moved out 1 week before 9/11. Wasn't that a, you know, fortuitous decision to leave? And then you've got P-TECH, which was an Israeli linked to Israeli intelligence, which is supplying software to the FAA and the FBI and U.S. Armed Forces they were using on 9/11. And then you've got major Zionists involved in that famous PNAC report, project, you know, the Project for a New American Century,
yep.
Calling for rebuilding America's defenses. They called for a new Pearl Harbor, and that included people like Paul Wolfowitz, who used to live in Israel, and Dov Zakheim, many Israeli-linked people calling for a new Pearl Harbor. And the person that I like to focus on, because it bears on the section I'll be getting to on what happened to the planes, is Danny Lewin. Now, Danny Lewin was a former major in the IAF, the Israeli Defense Force, and he was in their special ops, the it's like our Navy SEALs, the Sayeret Matkal. And according to the mainstream media, he was trained to kill people with a credit card or a pen. I mean, he was an assassin. And I have these pictures. I can't show you the pictures right now, but it's in my article, 9/11 Simplified. The year before 9/11, Danny Lewin had himself photographed in an official portrait taken in front of two panels that looked like the Twin Towers. And his thumb is pointing to his watch. And the watch, when you blow it up, you see that the model name is Hijacker. It was a Swatch Hijacker model watch. And we've got a picture of the ad there. I'm not the person who discovered these things. Other researchers have done that. But the watch, the hour hand, second hand, minute hand, and date were all set to 11. And the odds against that being by chance were over 20,000 to 1. And where was Danny Lewin on 9/11? He was in row 9 of flight 11. And I'm sorry, but wearing a hijacker watch with those numbers and him and being in that seat with a big smile on his face and his portrait, I believe he has a big role in 9/11. But the summary I would give you, and we're not going over, I'm only giving you like a smattering of the connections of Israel, but when you look at the people connected to Israel, connected to 9/11, they keep going back to Israel. They're not going back to, Sweden or, to Iran or some other country. It's always Israel again and again. But the question that I think people should really think about is who benefited from 9/11, because the United States didn't benefit. We've got TSA and the Patriot Act and a police surveillance state, and we spent trillions of dollars on wars that, you know, turned again and again not to be necessary. No weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, for example. And the Muslims who allegedly perpetrated this event certainly didn't benefit. Look at Libya, look at Syria, look at Afghanistan, look at Iraq. We've turned the Middle East into chaos, and the only people benefiting are the Israelis who have sat back since 9/11 and watched as the United States has taken out their enemies one by one, which is fulfillment of the Greater Israel plan that was outlined by Theodore Herzl, Rothschild agent, in 1897. It was outlined in the 1980s, what was called the Yinon plan, where Israel declared as its goal the destabilization of all of its neighbors. And so they are the, you know, when you're a police detective and you're solving a crime, usually one of the first questions you ask is, well, who benefited from this crime? And Israel is the chief beneficiary. You have a whole ton of evidence linking them to it, and they have the motive. And what I'm going to look at next is they have the means. And I think, and this is something I brought up at the beginning of the article, is that we have a saying in the alternative media, the 9/11 truth community, that I think is misleading when we say 9/11 was an inside job. And what I wrote in the article was I think that a more accurate rendering is that 9/11 was an outside job primarily. That, in other words, yes, it was done with American assistance of people like Dick Cheney at an executive level. But I think when we're talking at the operational level, at the physical operational level, we're talking about Israelis. And a great analogy in my mind is the USS Liberty. I'm sure you guys, I wouldn't know if you've done shows on it with any of the Liberty survivors, but Israel attacked the USS Liberty in 1967 with orders to destroy the ship. They attacked it with napalm, machine guns, strafing, torpedoes, even machine gun the lifeboats. They wanted no survivors, and they flew in unmarked planes, the idea being to bring us, this was during the Six-Day War, and the idea was to bring the United States into the war on their side, making us think that the Egyptians had sunk the ship.
But that was done with Johnson's, after Johnson's direction, right?
Well, this is the exact point I'm making, is that at the executive level, just like with Dick Cheney on 9/11, you had Defense Secretary McNamara and President Johnson recalling fighters twice who were sent to rescue the Liberty and then ordering a big cover-up afterwards, very similar to 9/11. But at the operational level, it wasn't the U.S. Air Force that attacked the Liberty. It was the Israelis that attacked the Liberty. And I think that when we talk about the operational level of 9/11, that it was preponderantly an Israeli operation. Now, I may be wrong about that, but I found that 9/11 makes a lot more sense when we look at it that way, and that kind of segues us to the next parts about how 9/11 actually took place.
I don't want to put words in your mouth, but if I can just say this kind of like a disclaimer, because I can guarantee you my inbox by tomorrow morning is going to be filled with people saying, you're anti-Semitic.
Yep.
U-S-O-B. And those are the nice ones.
Okay,
but there's a way.
That's why I mentioned that my family is actually my father's side is Jewish.
Right.
Our family name was Perlovsky. We emigrated from Russia as Russian Jews in 1904, and so I haven't got an anti-Semitic or racist bone in my body. We're just dealing with the facts here. But Israel will use the anti-Semitic charge as a knee-jerk response to any attempt to honestly investigate this event. So I'm just going with the facts here.
I agree.
Give you the facts before about who was involved. People can check this themselves. I would recommend the going on the internet to the WikiSpooks article called 9/11 Israel Did It, and you will find incredible documentation of Israel's involvement.
Okay, one question before we move on.
Feel free to interrupt me anytime.
Yeah, well, you know, I love your presentation, and we don't want to interrupt. But would you say, given when we say, for example, when reference is made to Israel, their role in 9/11, would you say that when we talk, for example, we talk about the globalists in America, the CIA and stuff, we're not talking about the Americans, we're talking about the criminal cabal within the government itself, and would that apply to Israel?
Like the deep state, yeah.
Yeah, the shadow government.
Yes, because you know there are people in Israel who refuse to join, young people who refuse to join the IDF. One of my favorite people that I follow on Twitter is called Jews Against Zionism, and they have some of the best material out there. And there, you know, Henry Mackow, I've written many times for his website. He's Jewish. He is a critic of Israel, and Brother Nathaniel, who is a Jewish convert to Christianity, is a harsh critic of Israel. And, of course, Norman Finkelstein and Miko Peled, son of a famous Israeli general. There are many people who are Jewish who take issue with Israel's genocidal policies, that's not an inaccurate description of their treatment of the people of Gaza and Palestine. But they are not anti-Semitic. They're Jewish. And so we need to make that distinction. We're just like in a courtroom where we're dealing with the facts here, and we want to remove any prejudices. I'm not speaking from prejudice, and if I make a remark from prejudice, it should be evident, because in that case, I would just be speaking out of hatred, and I would not be citing factual references.
And there we go. And that's all that's needed for the disclaimer. That's all we're going to provide. That's all that's necessary in my view. Let's get back to court. I love this presentation. I love your style. I love the presentation of this. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. By the way, to fully understand it all, you really have to understand Israel's plan and the whole Luciferian scheme of world government. Israel and Jerusalem are to be the capital of that world government. That's even biblical. You can find that in 2 Thessalonians, where the Apostle Paul spoke of the man of lawlessness reigning, pretending to be God in God's temple in Jerusalem. So that's, you know, that's really what the Greater Israel Project's about. But let's get back to 9/11. Three parts to this. One is, the first of the three is, what took down the towers? And I know that there are three major camps of thought. I have friends in all of them, and it doesn't impede my friendship with those people that we have different views. One camp is nanothermite. One camp is directed energy weapons. The third major camp is nukes, and I do believe it was nukes. And I have a major article on this called 9/11 and Beyond, the Israeli Rothschild Obsession with Nuclear Weapons. But this more recent article called 9/11 Simplified, I broke it down into my top 10 reasons as to why this was a nuclear event. And we're talking about two Israeli suitcase nukes. But let's talk about the top 10 reasons why it was nuclear. Number one, we know that first responders to 9/11 get a lot of cancer, but what type of cancer do they get more than any other cancer in ratio to its expected normal rate? And the answer is thyroid cancer, and that's a signature of an atomic bomb. An atomic bomb gives off iodine-131, which embeds in your thyroid. It will cause cancer, and that's why some people keep potassium iodide tablets on hand to protect the thyroid in the event of a nuclear attack. Number two is the U.S. Geological Survey examined dust samples to the World Trade Center and found unexplicably high correlations of the products of nuclear fission, such as strontium, uranium, thorium, cadmium. And this is all described back in 2006 by a gentleman named William Tahill in his book, The Nuclear Destruction of the World Trade Center. But it hasn't been highlighted very much, of course, in mainstream media. Number three is the extreme heat. All that molten steel, you know, a nuclear bomb will reach millions of degrees at its epicenter. It's an extremely hot event. And I should mention, with the help of people who are expert in nuclear weapons, our determination is that there were two suitcase nukes, one in each twin tower. They were in the service pits of elevator 50. That is the only elevator that ran the full length of either twin tower. It went in, there were six basement levels to the twin towers, and this went down below the sixth basement level. It was the only elevator whose service pits were carved into the bedrock, which made it the perfect launching pad for a nuclear weapon, because the bedrock would contain the sideways and downward force of the blast, letting the upwards force of the blast go straight up into the tower. That molten steel and the found down there and the fires that lasted for over 3 months, a nuke would account for that. Number four is the extreme force of the blast. In other words, pieces of the twin towers that weighed multiple tons, and one piece flew across the street and embedded itself in the American Express building. Other pieces went 600 feet. They knocked over the Winter Garden atrium. Now, where do you get that kind of force? Well, a nuclear explosion is the most powerful explosive known to man. Number five is what Judy Wood calls the dustification of the towers. You know, no toilet survived, no filing cabinets except for one out of 10,000, no furniture, no computers. They were all turned to dust. And a nuclear bomb is not like a stick of dynamite that goes bang and it's done. A nuclear bomb, you've seen the pictures, it keeps on exploding. It keeps on applying that nuclear force, and we believe that is what caused this tremendous down to the dust level effect on the twin towers.
I will say this, Mr. Perloff. I was there behind the crime scene tape, compliments courtesy of a detective. I just have one word for what I saw, aside from bloodstained sidewalks on a couple of occasions. That sticks in my mind. Dust. That's it. Dust. Mm-hmm. It's all.
Absolutely true. And you can see it just in the clouds that people were escaping or trying to escape. Number six is the seismographs, which Columbia University recorded at Palisades, New York. Now, again, you have to refer to my articles for the graphics on this, but on the you can see when the planes hit, there's a little blip on the seismograph. But when the towers collapse, the spike goes off the charts. And there was an enormous explosion at that time, and that would be consistent with a nuclear detonation. Number seven is really interesting, and this is where I had help from others. And remember, we were talking about the nukes being in the service pits of Elevator 50 at the deepest level. Well, you know that the rest of the World Trade Center also caught fire. You know, Building 7 was on fire. Building 5 was completely ablaze. Number 6 was cratered out. And when did that happen? You know, it couldn't have been before the towers collapsed, because if it did, then CNN's camera would have panned down and said, well, gee, Building 7's on fire. So when did these buildings catch fire? Some people say, well, there were bombs in those buildings. Well, if there were bombs in those buildings, why weren't they successful at collapsing the smaller buildings when they had such great success at collapsing the Twin Towers? And the answer is that underground, the World Trade Center was interconnected by a stormwater drainage system. We know this from Larry Silverstein's insurance evaluation report, because they've gotten rid of the blueprints for the World Trade Center, the original one, you know, so we can't look at that. But underground, they're all interconnected. And what happened was this, the force of the nuclear blast didn't just go up through that shaft of Elevator 50 following the path of least resistance. It also followed the path of least resistance underground to, because when you want to drain out a stormwater drainage, you go to the lowest point of any building. That's the service pits of Elevator 50. So you've got pipes there that go up. They connect to this underground system. And that secondary force of these nukes, that's why in Building 7, when Barry Jennings, the emergency center coordinator, he was going down the stairs with a colleague, and he said there was a bottom-up explosion, extreme heat. It destroyed the stairwell beneath him, and his colleague had to retreat upstairs and get saved by the New York City Fire Department. And he said how hot it was in there. And that's the secondary force of the nuke. And as evidence of that, and you'll see this in my articles, there were geysers bursting out of ground, first as steam, then as smoke. When the south tower, the first tower, collapsed, you can see that this overpressure from these underground pipes is bursting out of the World Trade Center. You don't notice it because your attention's all on the tower collapsing. But another evidence for this is that as people are fleeing from that big dust cloud on the New York City streets, in front of them, there's smoke pouring up out of the sewers. Again, people don't catch this. Where's the smoke coming from? It's coming from the secondary effect of that nuke, because this sewer and stormwater or drainage system ultimately emptied into New York City's sewers, and that's why you got the smoke pouring up out of the sewer system. Number eight is the dust cloud itself. If you watch video of American military nuclear tests, you'll see that it's not just a mushroom cloud, but there's a ground level dust cloud, and that cloud on 9/11 was hot, and I believe that's not just from building collapse, that is from a nuke. Number nine is from Susan Lindauer. I don't know if she's ever been on your show before. She has a show of her own. She was a CIA asset. She went to jail, federal prison, for her trouble, but she's a whistleblower. She blew the whistle on the fact that the U.S. had foreknowledge of these attacks, that the CIA did know that the World Trade Center would be attacked. And according to Lindauer, this is her testimony, the advance warning they had was that the World Trade Center would be destroyed by a mini nuke before 9/11 happened. They already had that information. Number 10 is from Benjamin Netanyahu. He wrote a book in 1995 called Fighting Terrorism, and here's what he wrote, quote, "Such groups," meaning Islamic groups, "nullify the need to have air power or intercontinental missiles as delivery systems for an Islamic nuclear payload. They will be the delivery system. In the worst of such scenarios, the consequences would not be a car bomb, but a nuclear bomb in the basement of the World Trade Center," unquote, Benjamin Netanyahu. And if you go to my articles, you will see a videotape of Netanyahu 2 days after 9/11 talking to Tom Brokaw, boasting of how he predicted a nuclear bomb would be placed in the World Trade Center.
And that's amazing.
Those are my 10 reasons why I think that it was a nuclear event.
And that, of course, ladies and gentlemen, is from jamesperloff.com. 9/11 Simplified. Now, if we can go back a little bit, okay, you laid out the 9 points there, all right? So, one of the questions that I've got is the gentleman depicted in the image that you mentioned, the seated in row 9 of flight 11 directly behind Muhammad Atta was Danny Le Guin, and former captain of IDF. What's his disposition? I mean, is there something that we should know? What was his position and now disposition with respect to his involvement in this? If that question makes sense.
He's been turned into a hero of 9/11, and they say that he died trying to stop the hijacking and sort of the first victim of 9/11, and I think that's part of the way they want it scripted. But if you look at the FBI transcripts of the phone calls from the flight attendants on Flight 11, Amy Sweeney and Betty Young, they repeatedly identified the hijackers in being from Row 9, which was Danny Lewin's row, okay, and as well as Row 2. And I do believe they're in Row 2 as well. I do believe that they had the numbers correct. There were about 5 hijackers on each plane, but I'm going to be getting to that. I don't, they certainly weren't Hani Hanjour and these other Arabs that were claimed by the U.S. government. But Danny Lewin was in row 9, and the flight attendants repeatedly identified the hijackers as being in row 9. But now, if you look at the official passenger layout of flight 11, it shows Muhammad Atta in row 8. You look at those transcripts, never once did the flight attendant say there was a hijack in row 8. No Muhammad Atta, according to the flight attendants. Nobody in row 8 at all. But they moved it up from row 9 to row 8, I think, to take the heat off of Lewin.
Got it. Okay. Thank you for that.
I may be wrong. You know, that's, well, you know, hypothetical.
But you know, it's a great, and folks, jamesperloff.com, 9/11 Simplified. I've read it. I've studied that article. And I'll tell you what, I can't find, from an investigative point of view, in a courtroom, this is, to me, this would be exhibits 1 through 10, and of course the ancillary exhibits based on the bullet points. I can't find anything wrong in this, or at least not with the logic. So, hey, go ahead and take it from here. Continue on.
We'll go on to part two, and do please intercede any time, because, you know, I may be writing a book on this to kind of bring all these articles together, and the more it's criticized and vetted by others, the better the final product will be. So feel free to chip in with any criticism. The second part is what actually hit the towers. And, you know, I don't believe that the planes, Flight 11 and 175, hit the towers. And I'm kind of divided on this, but I'm really leaning towards that. We'll have to say, I'm not 100% no planes, but I'll have to say that no planes as far as 11 and 175 go. When I first heard no planes, I thought, you know, this is ridiculous. You guys are nuts. This is cognitive dissonance. You're going to try and discredit the entire 9/11 movement by suggesting there are no planes, because everybody on 9/11 saw that plane coming in and hitting that second tower. Okay, but then I started to look at the other locations on 9/11. I look at Shanksville, and the coroner at Shanksville, his name was Wallace Miller. You know, he spent 20 minutes at that hole in Shanksville, and he said, I'll quote him exactly, he said, quote, "This crash was different. There was no wreckage and no bodies," unquote. And it was not even a drop of blood at Shanksville. And, you know, you look at MH-17 and these other crashes, and there's wreckage and fuselage everywhere, but somehow we're supposed to believe that the hole just swallowed up that plane. So I said, there's no real sign of a plane there. And then you look at the Pentagon, and there's a quote I love to use. It's from Karen Katowski, Lieutenant Colonel Karen Katowski, PhD, U.S. Air Force, retired, who was at the Pentagon that day. Here's her quote. "There was a dearth of visible debris on the relatively unmarked Pentagon lawn where I stood only minutes after the impact. Beyond the strange absence of airliner debris, there was no sign of the kind of damage to the Pentagon structure that one would expect from the impact of a large airliner. This visible evidence, or lack thereof, may also have been apparent to the Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, who, in an unfortunate slip of the tongue, referred to the aircraft that slammed into the Pentagon as a missile," unquote, Lieutenant Colonel Katowski. Now, also, if you go to YouTube or my article, you'll see April Gallup, who was in the Pentagon that day. I'm sure you've probably heard of her. She walked through that hole with other Pentagon employees the very hole that the plane allegedly went through, and she said there were no signs of an airplane, no luggage, no seat cushions, no bodies, nothing that would indicate a plane had been there. And, of course, it didn't even scuff the lawn, you know, but it flew right next to the lawn. And, of course, Major General Albert Stubblebine, former head of military intelligence, has said he believes it was a missile. Even one of the 9/11 commissioners, like Donald Rumsfeld, slipped up and slip of the tongue said it was a missile that hit the Pentagon. So when I started looking at, back at the Twin Towers, I said, is it possible using the same modus operandi at all four places? And I'm going to give you my top reasons now why Flight 175 could not possibly have hit the second tower. Number one, on all images of Flight 175, and there's many of them, there's actually dozens of video that we have of the second plane. We only have that famous one of the first plane in North Tower. But you can see that there's something that looks like a missile underneath it, and it's attached to it. And there is no way that at Logan Airport, something the size of a cruise missile could have been attached to the underside of Flight 175 without the crew noticing it, the maintenance crew, or the baggage handlers. And this is something that the guy who I call Pilot A, it's in my article called Conversations with an Airline Pilot About 9/11, he pointed out that it's mandatory before takeoff that the captain or co-pilot or the first officer, they have to do a walk around of a plane before takeoff. It's mandatory to see if anything's wrong. There's no way they miss a missile being on underneath that aircraft. So that right there is proof positive, I believe, that 175 did not hit the South Tower. But let's look at the other evidences. If we look at Flight 175, it was traveling at 590 miles per hour. That is an unattainable speed at ground level for a Boeing 767. It can't fly that. Its max operating speed is about 424. It could do over 500 at high altitude where the atmosphere is thin, but it even coming out of a dive, I mean, if it went straight into the ground, it'd be going over 500 miles an hour, but that thing is already leveled off when it hits the South Tower. It can't do that speed. And I want to point out something that's really important. All three objects that hit on 9/11, the Twin Towers and the Pentagon, they all made bullseye hits, impossibly perfect bullseye hits. But, you know, at 590 miles an hour, you cannot control a Boeing. And just imagine for a minute that flight, if it was Flight 175, that whether the flight is being controlled or whether it's, you know, there's a pilot controlling it. Let's say it just clipped the South Tower with its wing and crashed somewhere else in New York City. 9/11, the whole plane is kaput now. There's no way you can collapse the towers if the plane misses. They had to have it guaranteed in advance, guaranteed absolutely 100%. That all these targets would be struck with bullseyes. You can't guarantee that with a Boeing going at 590 miles per hour. And don't believe it. I've got an embedded clip there. You can also find it on YouTube. It's from Pilots for 9/11 Truth. It's called Airplane Controllability. And it shows how an airplane becomes uncontrollable at that speed. And they had pilots who were experienced Boeing pilots get onto simulators and try to duplicate the hits on the World Trade Center. And none of them get hit. There were twin towers at those speeds. It's impossible. So how did these Arabs do it, you know, who had never even been in a Boeing cockpit before? It's really ridiculous. That's proof number two. Proof number three is the fact that if you look at the footage of the alleged 175 hitting the South Tower, the plane goes right into it. I mean, the wings don't shear off that are made of aluminum. The aluminum tail doesn't shear off. The nose doesn't crumple, even though the nose... an airplane nose has been crumpled by bird impacts. The pilot, the guy called Pilot A, he's an active Airbus pilot, he pointed out that the fuselage should have crumpled on impact. There's no way it flies into the building. Doesn't even decelerate. It just keeps going at the same speed, and it's impossible, okay? And but he said for him that the real killer was when, it comes out the other side. You can see the nose coming out the other side of the building in some of the footage, and that is impossible. And some people said that's a puff of smoke. But people have blown up the image of that nose coming out. It's very distinct. It's not a cloudy, nebulous bit of smoke. It is clearly an airliner nose emerging the other side of the building. There's no way it can go through those 14-inch steel column after 14-inch steel column and come out intact on the other side. So we're looking at an illusion. We're not looking at Flight 175. Something solid did hit the towers, that's for sure. And that was proven by Richard D. Hall, who he did a marvelous thing. He actually made a scale model of New York City on his computer and took the 26 best film footages of that object hitting the Flight 175, allegedly hitting the South Tower, and he found that in all 26 videos, it follows the precise same trajectory. So it's not CGI, computer-generated images made it after the fact. There was a real object that hit the tower. And I think the best explanation is a cloaked missile. And the reason I say that is that a missile can be controlled precisely at that speed, and its nose is hardened for penetration, unlike a jetliner nose. And it also, the military has plenty of experience driving, hitting buildings with missiles, but not with planes. And I've lost my train of thought.
Alright, so we're looking at missiles, cloaked as planes, basically, right?
Right.
There's no CGI.
There's no other explanation as to how the nose of the plane made it all the way through the steel frame.
Right. And I agree. Now with that, and I don't want to take you further off your train of thought, but I've heard the argument. Well, you know, have you ever seen damage from a tornado? You see a piece of straw embedded in, you know, the side of a building from the force of the wind, from a tornado. Yes. Okay. Does that argument hold water in this case, or is there a comparable aspect to that in this case, or with respect to the planes, or no?
You know, I would really have to look at those tornadoes and what was specifically happening and what the piece of straw was embedding itself into. I need to look at that further, but I do know that we've got footage of airplane crashes, and they just can't do it. I mean, I do have some footage of an airliner in a crash that hit some telephone poles, and these wooden telephone poles sheared the wings off the plane. As opposed to 14-inch thick steel columns. It just, based on the experience of airplanes, it doesn't happen. I'm not sure about tornadoes, what's going on there. And that's a great point, and I don't want to try and analyze it on air, because, you know, I'm going to try and think it through and mess up, you know, but let me give that some thought. That's an important point.
All right.
And one that should be addressed and resolved. But I think in terms of what we have from experience with jetliners, what happened on that day was impossible. Now, there's also another thesis, which is a drone thesis. The problem I have with a drone thesis is that I don't think you can control a drone at 590 miles an hour either, and its nose can't penetrate, and I don't know how the wings of a drone can fly through steel either. It could account for some of the limited airliner debris that was found afterwards. But, you know, if you're going to create the illusion of a plane going through the Twin Towers, you would have to plant some debris. And there were these Israeli trucks moving around on 9/11. One of them was a famous mural van that the police caught. And what were those trucks doing out there? And this is an important point. This is made by Pilot A. Apparently, no piece of debris, airline debris, that was found after 9/11 has ever been matched at serial numbers to the aircraft that it came from, which is pretty interesting. Every aircraft part, like a piece of landing gear, has got a serial number. It's a unique serial number. There are manifests and logs which will show which plane that went to. And for some reason, the National Transportation Safety Board has never matched a single piece of 9/11 debris to the planes. But a drone, I think it has problems. Is it really realistic that they would have planted airline debris? I think it may be, because they went to a lot of trouble to create illusions on that day. And by the way, speaking in terms of holographic technology, I think that I should back up and mention one thing. People say that this technology doesn't exist, but actually the Air Force itself in the 1990s, this is on their own webpage before they took it down, had what they call the Airborne Holographic Projector. And I'll describe what the Air Force said. It said, quote, "The holographic projector displays a three-dimensional visual image in a desired location. It can be used for psychological operations and strategic perception management. It's useful for optical deception and cloaking, providing a momentary distraction when engaging an unsophisticated adversary." And it goes on. And the Air Force actually put an image there of a three-dimensional airplane being projected as a hologram to deceive enemy aircraft gunners. So we had that technology. We both knew we had that technology. And that was in broad daylight. So this technology did exist. And I should also mention, it's kind of like to close it out, I was wondering, what about Israel, if this is Israel operational? In 1999, Israel replace its old 1970s-era subs with new Dolphin-class subs, which were capable of firing cruise missiles. And in the year 2000, the U.S. Navy spotted, this is from Wikipedia, U.S. Navy spotted the Israelis test-firing cruise missiles from their new Dolphin-class subs in the Indian Ocean. That's 1 year before 9/11. So they had this new technology, and I'll add to that that according to the Defense Department memo called Critical Technology Assessment in Israel, the Israeli firm L-Op was developing holographic technology with, quote, stealth applications, unquote, as early as 1987. So the Israelis did have the capacity to launch a cruise missile, and they were working on stealth applications. That doesn't prove they did it, but it certainly, when you tie together what we were saying before about Israel's benefits from this the 9/11 event and all their connections to it, it raises again the possibility that they were actually the operational factor. Because you know what I mean? They were the ones who attacked USS Liberty. And you know what? I don't think you could get a U.S. Navy crew and Annapolis graduates to launch cruise missiles against the White House, the Pentagon, the World Trade Center on 9/11. But the Israelis, they wouldn't hesitate. They've attacked us many times, whether you're talking about King David Hotel in 1946, Lavon Affair in 54, La Belle Discotheque in 86, or the USS Liberty in 1967. They wouldn't hesitate to launch against an American site.
Good points all, and important points all, too. So, and folks, our guest is Mr. James Perloff, jamesperloff.com. His website available or accessible in the program description, the link there. Two articles of note right now at present, 9/11 Simplified, and also a conversation with an airline pilot. I believe I got that right. Conversations with an airline pilot about 9/11. And that's accessible via his website. And we're talking about evidence. We're talking about facts. We're not talking about anything else. And, of course, it's very well laid out at his website. I would encourage everyone to go there. Incredible researcher. And but go ahead and continue, sir.
Well, I realize we missed our break, didn't we?
Well, what we're doing, I should have told you this, in deference to you, so you can get your complete presentation and train of thought. We're going to skip the bottom of the hour breaks. So you've got the full segments, both of them.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Well, the third part, and this is kind of where we go into a new direction here, is what happened to the planes and passengers. And I started to look at this and, you know, trying to solve this. If I was the Israelis, how would I carry it out? And I reached a conclusion, guys, that in the alternative media, I think we've reached a couple of wrong conclusions. And the subtitle of 9/11 Simplified is, yes, Virginia, there were hijackers on the 9/11 planes, but not the ones we were told. Now, here's the thing. Leading up to 9/11, there was this narrative established that was going to blame this on Osama bin Laden and his motley crew of Arab hijackers. So you had these guys who went into Florida, these bars in Florida, you know, Shuckum's Oyster Bar and was it Jack's Red Eye Jack Sports Bar, and they bought lap dances, and they left their Corian at the bar, and left their IDs, left their business card, and credit card receipts, and copies of their driver's licenses. And they paid with $100 bill, and they got into a shouting match over the bill with the bartender, and one of them said, "I'm a pilot," and they're doing all they could to draw attention to themselves, and then. Morning of 9/11, of course, there was that famous car in Logan Airport that had a Koran and a flight training manual in it. They're setting this whole narrative that these were the guys at the flight training schools. And then on the morning of 9/11, Muhammad Atta's luggage fortuitously did not make it onto Flight 11, you know. And of course, why would you bring luggage on a suicide mission anyway? But that his luggage didn't get on, and inside the FBI find the IDs and the whole plan, right? And so that's basically how they got the 19 hijackers identified so quickly. But then here's why I think we started to take a wrong turn in 9/11 truth. We looked at this and we started to realize that close to half those hijackers turned out to be alive. And you know, the 9/11 commission, which was chaired by dual Israeli citizen Philip Zelikow, didn't bother to look into the mistaken identities on the hijackers, nor did the FBI, that we know about. And so we say, okay, and we also know that even if they were on those planes, those guys were lousy pilots. There's no way they could have piloted with that accuracy. So we start to say, okay, there were no hijackers on board. and no hijackers means no hijacking. So we start to say, okay, so there's no hijacking. That means the passengers and the flight attendants are all a bunch of liars, and they're in cahoots with the CIA. And we start to draw their families into it. Say that the families are in on it too. We start to say, well, those flight attendants and those passengers, they didn't exist, or they were given new identities and paid $1 million. And you know what, though, guys, you know, I don't think you get $1 million and a new identity for a 30-second phone call. And most of those passengers and flight attendants didn't make phone calls. There's only a very few people that did. So we come up with another theory, which is the CIA morphed their voices. And I've gone down that road. And if you look at my book, Truth is a Lonely Warrior, which is a primer in the New World Order, that's kind of the road I'm going down, is following what everybody else said, that there was an electronic hijack. But then I started to look at this, and I'll show this to you guys, and this is what I do in all these interviews. But if you were on a plane, would you feel more comfortable if the plane was being flown by two pilots, or would you feel more comfortable if the plane was being remotely flown to your destination?
Yeah. Well, obviously, two pilots on board, they've got skin in the game, as opposed to somebody on the ground who does not, literally.
Right. Right, exactly. And I think that if you are a intelligence service who's running 9/11, you also want your best people at the controls of that plane. You're not going to try and electronically maneuver those four aircraft. And what I realized is that this is being carried out. It's not Mossad. They wouldn't even trust Mossad with this job. This is Danny Lewin, you know, the guy with all the 11s in the row 9 of Flight 11. This is a group, Sayeret Matkal. They specialize in terrorism, or they say anti-terrorism, and assassination. And I believe they entered those planes under Muslim ID, but they're the ones who carried out the hijacking. And I think that the phone calls are real. And this is something that just jumped out at me. It was an amazing sentence that I found in the September 21st London Telegraph. Quote, accounts from other doomed planes indicate the hijackers encouraged people to call their families and tell them what was happening, unquote. Now, guys, what kind of hijacker encourages the victims to call their families and tell them what's happening?
Compassion.
Well, the Israelis would, because just like Charlie Hebdo. You know, in Charlie Hebdo, you had these guys who ran outside and they were disguised, but they seemed to be military special ops. They knew how to use these automatic weapons. They even chased away a police car. And they're yelling, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar, for the cameras on the roof, you know? And I think that's exactly what they were doing on 9/11. They were continuing just what they did at Shechem's Oyster Bar. They're established as a Muslim hijacking, but they're physically hijacking the plane. And as we looked into this, and I looked into this help not only with pilots' help, with the help of my friend Mary Ellen Moore, who is a career flight attendant. She's the co-producer of my movie Shadow Ring, which is another primer on the New World Order. How do you think these guys got into the cockpit so quickly and killed the pilots? They had a key. It turns out that on 9/11, every American Boeing on takeoff would lock its door to the cockpit because of the history of hijackings in the past. But I had a question. Is it a unique lock and key set, or is it universal? And we did some research and found it was universal because the airline presumed that no hijackers ever going to get a key. So all you had to do if you're an Israeli special op is borrow a key from El Al, Israeli's airline. And these guys knew exactly how to fly a Boeing, because they're not Mohammed Atta and Hani Hanjour. These guys have flown on LL 757s and 767s, of which they had many in their fleet. They've flown as jump seaters and then as co-pilots, and they know all the controls on a 911 Boeing 757 or 767. They get into the cockpit. They're in the front row of first class on Flight 11 and probably in every plane. So all they have to do, while the guys back in row 9 are distracting the flight attendants, they simply stand up, open the cockpit with their key, kill the pilots instantly. Remember, Danny Lewin was trained to kill with a credit card or a pen, and they all were. This is their assassination team. This is not Mossad. This is their Navy SEALs. This is their elite special ops. These are their trained assassins. They kill those pilots instantly, and that's why there were no hijack codes punched in that day, not because of an electronic hijack. And I got to tell you something, guys, something, okay? This is what Pilot A told me, the Airbus pilot. You cannot electronically hijack those planes on 9/11 because 757s and 767s are flown manually. You can electronically hijack a 777 because it's all computers. just like cars are becoming all computers. But let me just quote this pilot, okay? Quote, conventional airplanes like a B-757, 767, A-300, etc. have a control yoke and pedals operating cables running the entire length and width of the airplane to the parallel actuators, hydraulic rams, which are directly connected to the moving surfaces, like the elevators. And he goes on with a great deal of technical detail. So when a pilot places a physical input into the control column, he's moving that cable along the various pulleys all the way to the lever or switch on the hydraulic rams, which in turn move the flight control surface. There are no computers in this basic operation, which is what made these old generation aircraft so dependable in basic flight training. This whole idea, unquote. So this whole idea that the planes were electronically hijacked, that was planted in our minds in 2001. There was a TV show called The Lone Gunman. In their pilot episode, they actually had a plane being electronically hijacked and flown to the World Trade Center. And at the last second, the heroes save it. But this idea has been put in our mind. You know, you couldn't do it. You cannot electronically hijack a 757, a 767, a modern computer-run 777 fly-by-wire. Yes, you can, but not on 9/11. You need physical pilots at those controls, and that's all you're going to trust anyway. You want military special ops in that cockpit. They went into that cockpit. They locked the door behind them. They're now in control. They know how to fly a Boeing.
And James, we've heard lots of different theories as to how the hijackers got into the cockpits, and also what you mentioned earlier is the plane that hit the Pentagon made that enormous maneuver at a rate of speed that was almost impossible in a way that was so perfect even most trained pilots couldn't do it.
But
we're right up against the break, James. Our guest is James Perloff. He'll be with us in through the next hour until the end of the show, so don't go anywhere. We will be right back with Mr. Perloff after this.
Just what kind of thriller predicts the future? In 3 days in the Belly of the Beast, Daniel Holdings wrote about the God Particle before CERN actually discovered the God Particle. In As the Darkness Falls, Daniel wrote about an Islamist terrorist confederacy that rose up out of Syria and declared a caliphate 3 years before ISIS was ever heard of. In his newest novel, Between the Veil, Daniel talks about a space between dimensions where supernatural beings can walk. He says that these novels are a warning from the Creator to his creation. Will war come to America? Will the world's economies collapse? Are we looking at increased earthquakes and volcanic activity? Will the United States fall into civil war? You can find all of Daniel's work at his website, danielholdings.com. That's danielholdings.com. All of these things and more are talked about in Daniel's books. To find out what's coming next, go to danielholdings.com.
Worldwide demand is making coconuts one of the highest-yielding cash crops available today. Coca-Cola, Pepsi, and many high-net-worth individuals have invested billions of dollars into coconuts for strong growth and solid long-term income. Yields could be as high as 18% or more per year. Capital appreciation and exceptional income for up to 60 long years would be an absolutely brilliant investment to pass on to future generations. Diversify wisely with direct ownership of fully managed coconuts on prime farmland close to the beautiful Costa Rican border. For more information, qualified accredited investors should go to profitsincoconuts.com or phone 855-888-6288. That's 855-888-6288. This announcement does not constitute an offer to sell securities or a solicitation of an offer to purchase. Offer made by prospectus only. 855-888-6288 or visit profitsincoconuts.com. Profitsincoconuts.com.
You may never look at your city, town, or its people the same way ever again. Stained by Blood, a murder investigation based upon a true story by private investigator Douglas J. Hagman. Using the character Mark Stiles, Hagman takes you on a journey behind the scenes where the homicide becomes secondary to an underworld of satanic ritual abuse, child abduction, and even mind-controlled experimentation. For 5 years, a brutal killer remained on the loose, free to kill again. As Mark struggles to navigate the maze of bizarre twists and untangle a web of deeply hidden secrets kept by some of the most powerful and influential people in his community and beyond. Stained by Blood. Order your copy of this engaging novel today at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood at HagmanandHagman.com and click on the link. Stained by Blood.